Do you remember when you first expressed an interest in music as well as percussion?
Yes, it was. I was very young. I was, I think my sister. I have two sisters, and we used to do these puppet shows for kids on our street in Cleveland, where I grew up. And I remember playing on upside down waste baskets and pots and pans, and we used to get these potato chips delivered called Charlie Chips, and they came in these big canisters, which were beautiful sounding drums. And I used to play on those, and I must have been about 5 or 6, maybe, around that age.
Did you drive your family crazy?
They were pretty tolerant. It was amazing. And then we had this house, in a suburb of Cleveland, and they just put me in the basement, and then they were pretty
Lock
cool about it.
the
Yeah. Well, you know what? I was kind of shy at first. I didn't want to play in front of people, and then, so whenever they would hear me play when I was that age, I would make them go, not stare at me. Just I would make them go upstairs or stand on this.
Was your family musical at all?
Yeah, my dad played clarinet, and my wife, who plays sax and flute, Jenny Hill, she has his original clarinet. Anyway, so he was musical, and my mom was a singer. Not professionally, but she liked to sing, and she could definitely carry a tune. And my dad also was a DJ in high school. He had his business card said "Music Fast and Slow" by Mark and Joe, and they went to, so they would play, handle all these social events at the high school, and they had lots of great records that unfortunately he sold before I was of age to get them. He regrets that. He wanted me to have that collection. But he didn't think about it.
What kind of music did he play?
Well, he had, he grew up in the big band era. He'll be 77 this year. So, he had all the big band stuff, and he liked jazz. He was really into all that stuff.
So he's one of your main early influences when it comes to love of music.
I guess so. Yeah. But then, I was listening to stuff on the radio when I was a kid, pop music. Like Elton John, and when I was maybe, I'm 47 now, so he was just coming in on the scene, and I remember hearing like Roberta Flack and a lot of R&B and stuff on the radio in Cleveland. There was such an eclectic scene there.
And Cleveland is a musical city.
Really, for sure. I mean, they lobbied to get that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And they really worked hard to get it. That's one aspect of it, but also the jazz thing and the R&B scene, and it seemed to have a little of everything. Cleveland was a really soulful town to grow up in musically.
What for you are your top five jazz recordings of all time?
Maybe Mingus Changes One would be in there, something around that era. I like Miles Live Evil, like the Electric Miles, as well as the early stuff, Wayne Shorter's stuff. I like Weather Report a lot. Stuff that I came up in. And speaking of that, in high school, I did have a when I got into high school, I got real lucky. I met up with a guy, a couple people one guy whose father was a bass player, and he was very a musical guy, and he had eclectic interests in jazz. He knew everything from like Errol Garner to Weather Report to Miles. I mean, and he turned me on to all that stuff. So we had a band in high school and tried to play, just everything from like Chick Corea to, Louis Armstrong. I mean, and it was really amazing the scope of what we tried to do. I mean, I don't think we really pulled it off, but at least I got influenced by all that stuff.
Who are some of the important influences on your playing?
I was always into melody, and so, I could play. I was into like playing songs, whatever it may be that I was listening to, I would try and emulate it. And then I think as far as drummers, maybe Elvin Jones would be as strong as anyone. He's just his spirit, and not so much his style, because he's so hard to copy. But him and Tony Williams and a lot of the jazz masters, I would say.
If there's only one person living today that you would love to play with or even record with, who would that be?
Stevie Wonder.
And why is that?
Because I love him. I everything about him. Even if you just took his singing, the phrasing of the way he sings, it's so funky and so rhythmic that you could make a study of that alone. But then there's the whole spiritual aspect of him. And just the genius of him, and I actually got to see him in just a few months ago at Radio City. At Madison Square Garden, and he hadn't toured in 12 years to New York, so I was very excited to get that opportunity, and it was fantastic. He played for 3 hours, and you know, it's just there's something about him that really always gets me. And there was one point in my life I think I listened to Stevie Wonder for about a year and a half every day. Without stopping.
It's interesting because Stevie's music has such universal appeal.
Yeah.
And you never get sick of listening to it.
No.
You know,
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, jazz and you know, just the harmony of his thing is so unique, and he's so and you know, to grow up in the 70s when funk was like absolutely, you know, at its peak, you know, I think. It was just a gift to have him in my life. And it wasn't until later that I really began to just really love the way what he did.
And even as a writer arranger, he's excellent.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's nothing about him I can say that is disparaging in any way. And he's kind of religious somewhat, you know, I would say, and even that even comes out in his music, and I'm not really religious, I wouldn't say. I'm kind of, you know, everyone has their views of spirituality, but you know, he talks about, you know, God openly in his music, and that's not really something I do, but certainly respect, you know, his views.
How long did it take you to record Soul Drums?
Soul Drums was sort of I liken it to having a baby, you know, because I started the last day of August of last year. That was 06. I was going on the road with the guy that I went to Canada with, Rob Curto, and that day before I left, I started the first session, and that was August 30th of 06, and then I finished it by the second week of June of 07. So that's actually not that long a time to get a record done. I just had to do it. I was very urgently pressing forward to get that thing done.
When you made the recording, did you have a preconceived idea of what you wanted this recording to be?
Well, I had a bunch of originals written, and I also wanted to do a record of percussion vignettes, you know, percussion pieces. But I couldn't really afford to do two records. So I did both. I did the, you know, each tune is separated by the percussion vignettes, so it's sort of two in one, and I'm kind of marketing it to, I'm trying to get it reviewed in drumming magazines too, you know, drum and percussion publications.
The first thing I noticed when I heard that album was the clarity of the sound. Did you spend a lot of time trying to perfect the overall sound of the recording?
I was very fortunate that I didn't have to think so much about that. I was, of course, involved in it. I produced it along with my engineer friend, who's been with me I've known him now for probably almost 20 years. His name's Jim Klaus, and a lot of it was on him. He's at Park West Studios in Brooklyn. ParkWestStudios.com, I believe, is his address. And he's just a gifted musician and engineer. He plays drums and sax. And he just knows what to do. And he knew what I was going for because he knows me. So I'm very happy with the result.
When you compose music, does it take you a long time?
Sometimes, I think you've probably heard this before, sometimes it just comes out real fast if you get a melody in your head or a bass line. I know for doing Soul Drums, I have one of the drums I play is a Hajini, which is a two-chambered udu drum, and it can play sort of little melodies. And often at night I'll come home after a gig and I'll just play that for hours and come up with little bass lines or melody, you know, snippets of a melody. That's one way I do it. Sometimes I sit at a keyboard and just force out stuff or see what comes. And I have I collaborate somewhat on the harmony side of things with keyboard players to make it rich with harmony, but they're all my arrangements and my melodies.
It's amazing how interesting ideas can be when you just let them occur naturally.
I think that's the way it should be, but it, you know, it, sometimes it just doesn't come, and then other times it just, you can't stop it. You know, it's interesting. I think people who are prolific writers, unlike myself, they just make it a daily exercise, and they put it out there. You know, no matter what they write, you know, they'll just make themselves write every day, and then they'll go back and sort of fish out the good stuff. You know what I mean?
What do you like most about composing?
Well, as I said before, it's not something that I do every day. I'm trying to do more of it. It's fulfilling to come up with a melody that's memorable, and arrange it and get it out there.
Yeah, it's like to see it. It's really interesting to see it start off as a germ, and then evolve into something that's concrete and that you can work with.
Sure.
Yeah. Who've been some of your influences when it comes to composing?
I don't really know specifically a person. I know that I like melodies that have some chromaticism in them, but I can't really say specifically. If I hear a piece of classical music that I like, I heard one the other day and I can't even remember the composer, but you know, that'll hit me as much as a pop tune or a jazz, you know, a jazz guy. You know, I love the harmony in jazz. I love the tensions on the chords, and the richness of that.
And of course, the freedom.
Yeah, of course, the freedom. Yeah. To improvise over a simple melody, or you know, just open it up and do that. That's the best thing about jazz.
Do you ever have a chance to teach or mentor other musicians?
Sure, I have some private students right now, and I've done a bunch of master classes and clinics at different places, like Drummers, the Collective in New York and San Francisco State, and a couple other colleges, I enjoy that. Yeah, I do very much.
What's the best advice that you can give an up and coming musician?
Be open minded. That for me came. It just came naturally. Just be open minded. Discount any one kind of music, because you never know what you're going to hear that's going to move you. And I think that would be the main thing. And just have fun. I as far as making a living in music, that's another issue completely.
Yeah. Do you have a tendency to practice a lot?
I'm in a situation now where I'm looking for a good practice space. I might even be building one, building a room inside my co-op where I live in Brooklyn. That is a problem, the sound issue here, because people live, you know, right on top of each other, and it's so densely packed. Until I owned a place, I could always practice. When I was renting places, I always had situations where I could have sessions and practice pretty much during the daytime, and now I'm in a situation where I have to go out and rent different rooms, and I'm getting frustrated with that, and I want to be able to roll out of bed and just practice. So that's the current state of affairs.
So now that we're going into 2008, what projects do you have on the go?
Let's see here. That was one thing I did write down, believe it or not. I want to do more clinics, and I want to travel with my own group, the Todd Squad. I've got a really good the Brooklyn Arts Council gig coming up this summer. We don't have a date yet, but I applied for and got a grant through the Brooklyn Arts Council, and I'm going to do my band Secret Stevie, which does more obscure Stevie Wonder stuff in a sort of a jazz and world context. We're going to do a big outdoor concert this summer. And I just want to do more playing and more teaching and more traveling.
You had mentioned earlier about listening to Stevie Wonder. Is there anyone else these days that you're listening to?
recently, I've just listened to that Wayne Shorter live record that he just did, I think, in the last year or two. I listen to a lot of, like, Latin jazz and African music. I really love African music, like King Sunny Ade from...
oh, I love him, yeah.
From Nigeria.
Yeah.
And then I did a tour with this guy, Stefan Bauer, who's a great mallet man. He plays vibes and marimba. And we're going to be doing a Jenny's CD release at the end of the month at the Blue Note on the 28th. And he's going to be doing it with us. And he took me to Africa in 2002 with a grant from the Goethe Institute. And we went to four countries, and I just had a wonderful time listening to and playing with these African musicians that we met in Ivory Coast and Nigeria and Kenya, and it was a real special experience. I listen to everything, Middle Eastern music and South American stuff. I love Brazilian music. That's my other great love. In world music and jazz. I like to mix Brazilian and jazz, which a lot of people do these days. And I've been there a couple times and done some concerts down there. So, there's just anything goes.
So do you have an iPod that's just full of music?
Yes, I do.
It's probably your best friend now, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty convenient. I can't, it's a little strange to have music so absolutely immediately available to you all the time, and it's it has its drawbacks, but it's you can't beat the convenience of an iPod.
Nothing like it.
Yeah, I take it to the gym. I take it everywhere. I can put it in the car now.
Wow,
that's really great.
Aside from playing percussion, do you play any other instruments?
Not really. I'm not a piano player. I just use it for composing, and I would not call myself a piano player by any stretch. And I just drums and percussion are what I really focus on. I studied in India, so I use a finger technique that I've studied from Mridangam in South India, and I use that on all the different hand percussion things that I use. Pretty unusual percussion instruments.
Do you remember your first performance as a percussionist?
I think I do. I was in fifth grade, and the theme was happiness, and every tune had to have the name happy, like I want to get happy, or I want to be happy, and then get happy, like Sonny Rollins actually would play some of these tunes later on, I've discovered, and that was it. We played a set of music that had the name happy in it.
I want to get back to the touring you did of Africa and India. What has to be the most memorable concert that you gave on those tours?
By far, the most memorable and the most fulfilling was in Nigeria, a place that I was actually a little bit scared to go from everything I had heard. But obviously, that was we were in a very safe part of Nigeria in Lagos. I forget the name of the section we were in, but we were at the Goethe Institute. It was a lot of diplomats and people that were invited there. I didn't get to see much of Nigeria beyond that small part. But we opened up for a guy his name was Coyote, and I don't know if they mean it in the way that when we say Coyote here, but his name was Coyote, and we met backstage, and his band was opening for us or playing after us, and we started playing backstage, and then he invited me up to play drums with his band, which was very much like a Fela Kuti-type band. It had singers and dancers and percussionists, and he had a drum set player. And I had been playing percussion on the tour that I was on, but he let me come play drum set with his band, and it was maybe some of the best 20 minutes of my life playing with this guy.
That must have been a magical moment for you.
It was very, I'd have to say it was a magical moment. And the rest of the tour was also really great, but I didn't get that kind of opportunity in other places. We did play with other African musicians, which was incredible. But playing with this guy's band, it was really validating for me.
What were the countries that you toured again?
Well, we started in Abidjan and Ivory Coast, and then we drove through Togo and Benin, and that was fascinating. We almost got killed because the driver of our van fell asleep at the wheel, and we were also sleeping. And then he hit a pothole and woke up, and we wound up in a ditch. But we thank God we were all okay, and drove on to where were we? Before Nigeria, we went to Ghana, and that was incredible because we got to see a drumming school and visit the drumming school and play with them and just hang out with these guys. And it was called the Mustafa Teddy Eddy School of Drumming in Accra, Ghana. And then from there we drove into Nigeria, and then we flew to Kenya for the final leg of the trip, and that was also really interesting.
And when you were in India, was it mostly the southern part that you were performing?
Right, there I went mainly to study. My friend Jamie Haddad, who's also from Cleveland, the percussionist and drummer, he had gone there about 6 or 8 years prior to me. I think it was 6 years prior, to study with a man named Karikudi R. Money. And he kind of opened the door for other people to study with this man who's probably the greatest living mridangam player. And he has his own group. And I went there for 3 months to study with him. And then he also, while I was with him, he took me to Bangalore and also to Kerala to the Palghat Mani Iyer concert that they do every year. So that was a real treat. And I learned a lot from studying with him. I had about 2-3 lessons a week in India.
What was the most important lesson that you learned while you were over in India?
Live in a place where you can cook for yourself. Because I got sick. I was sick twice a week for 3 months. It never ended, and it was really uncomfortable physically. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was a really special experience.
But when it came to the music, were there any lessons that you took or observed that really left a profound influence on you?
Well, you know, I'd say it was outside of music, just experiencing, well, a couple things. The amount of humanity packed into a small place, which blew my mind. I had never seen anything like it. And the other interesting thing was I was a minority. You know, I'm this white Jewish kid from Cleveland, and I was in South India where people are very, very dark. Mm-hmm. And I was a minority. And I also befriended a 70-year-old Indian woman from Durban, South Africa, who happened to be living in the house that my school was housed in. And we became sort of friendly. And people would look at us. It was very taboo for us to be together, to be walking down the street together. And
we take a lot for granted over here.
Oh, we sure do. Yeah. We sure do. And I got just maybe a little glimpse of what it would be like to be an African American living in a heavily white area.
Yeah.
Maybe not even so much now as maybe years before or even now.
Yeah.
It was just very eye-opening for me in that way. So I'd say that may have been the heaviest thing that happened to me. The people of India were very very spiritual on the whole, and just I saw wild things. I saw one guy who was holding his hand above his head as to atone for something he may have done that he thought was bad, and he was holding his hand above his head for like a year.
A year. Wow.
And his fingernails were like, you know, grown out for a year. I mean, just crazy things like that. It's hard to even remember all the wild stuff I saw. So amazing.
How would you define jazz?
Just freedom in the music. You know, being able to express yourself. It's like an incredible gift that America has given to the world, and yet it's so barely recognized here. And it should be on every radio. Every city should have a government-run or at least government-sponsored radio station that plays jazz 24/7.
I agree.
It just doesn't happen. I mean, we need maybe. I'm very encouraged about the caucuses in Iowa yesterday.
It was interesting.
Not that this is directly going to win, but if going to get a jazz thing happening. But I always was a fan of Barack Obama way before anyone knew about him, and I think that he has a good chance now to get the nomination, and maybe if we can get the Congress and the presidency in the same party, we might be able to get some things done on the social side of things, and get some jazz going in this country as well as dealing with the other main big problems that we have in the country and the world.
Do you get a sense when you travel outside North America that there seems to be more of a deeper appreciation for the music than there is here?
Oh, absolutely.
And absolutely. Even a better understanding of the music, I would think.
Often the case, yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe the exception would be like in certain college campuses and things like that, or other urban areas where there's a little bit of a jazz audience. But other than that, I mean, I realized on the tour when I was in Ottawa and all the other parts of Canada and the Midwest of the United States that there wasn't very much interest in jazz, and it just wasn't a lot of exposure. I think if people were just exposed to it more, they might like it.
I would agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
Out of all the concerts that you've attended during your lifetime, what was the most memorable one?
Well, I remember the first jazz concert I ever saw blew me away. I had no idea what was going on, but I didn't leave the basement for a month after that. And that was the VSOP Quintet in like 77, I think it was.
With Herbie Hancock?
Herbie Hancock and Tony and Ron and, you know, and interesting, and Wayne. But interestingly, the set that I got to see, Freddie Hubbard had some sort of fit, and he never came out for the second set. But it was just the quartet. Yeah. And boy, was that amazing. You know, Tony Williams and his, you know, he had that yellow jumpsuit on with the lightning bolts on the side and the yellow Gretsch drums, and I just was so slack jawed. I went, and I don't think I left the basement for a month after that.
What a powerful drummer he was, and I don't mean so much from a sense of getting out there and playing faster than anyone. I mean from a melodic and just a sense of the rhythm and the whole package. I mean, Tony had it all.
He really did. Absolutely.
You know, when you listen to some of the music he made with Miles Davis, of course, the wide array of music he made with Miles Davis, it's interesting to follow Tony from when he first started, which was, what, about 17 years old, right up to his death. Incredible musician.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, even now, there'll never be another guy who plays like that, and his influence is just going to go way beyond his lifetime, way beyond, you know.
I want to talk a little bit about Jenny. How did you meet Jenny Hill?
I met Jenny, you know, I was at Berklee College of Music for a very short stint, and she was there. I did not meet her there. And in fact, at that time, there was only a handful of women in the whole school. And this was like in 80, 81, somewhere around there. And I remember seeing her walking down the steps, this tall white girl walking down the steps of the main building. And then 10 years later, I'm in New York, and I met her through some mutual friends. So there you go. And we met and started dating, and then we got married in 96. So that's the Jenny story.
You must get a opportunity to make music with her regularly.
Yeah, we do. And in fact, you know, we got that thing coming up at the Blue Note on the 28th, but she's also just put out her third CD, and I've been on all three of them, and fortunately, and they're really great. She's such a good composer, and got a great sound on tenor, a really beautiful, rich sound.
I first heard of Jenny years ago. She was on an LA Sax sampler.
Yeah, I remember that.
You mentioned earlier about Stefan Bauer. What was it like touring with him?
Do you know that he lived in Winnipeg for a long time? Yeah, he was a resident there for a long time, and it was really interesting. I mean, his music is very well thought out and through composed, and he had some. The pieces that we were doing were you know, pretty much through composed, but there was room for improvising too. And it was he has a real interesting concept in his music, and he's a heavy composer and great player.
Now about your drums, you must have a vast collection.
Well, not as vast as I'd like it to be, but I do have some new ones that are very interesting. I love the drum that's very close to my heart is the Hadjini, which is two guys' names put together, Haddad and Giorgini. My friend Jamie Haddad and Frank Giorgini. Jamie came up with the shape of this drum, took it to the maker of Udu drums that he knew at the time, Frank Giorgini, and they came up with this two-chambered sort of Udu drum, clay drum, that you can change the pitch with a little bit by opening and closing your hands over the air holes. And it was something that came out of Jamie's experience with Indian technique, so it was perfect for me, and it really worked out well. And then there's another drum that called the Udu Boo, which is just the if you can picture the widest piece of bamboo on earth, which is about I'd say 6 or 7 inches wide, and it's a tube around 2.5 feet long, and it also has air holes, and it's shaped like kind of like a merdungum, and you can also put a microphone in it, and it's beautiful. It's just a big chunk of bamboo, and you play on the membrane side, you know, and you can also use Indian technique with that, and that's also something that's featured on my CD. Especially on the last tune with David Phelps on guitar, that tune called Badia by Joe Zawinul. We do a version of that, and that's where that drum sticks out a lot. And then I got, you know, I'm into bongos and, you know, like clay bongos from the Mideast, and I've got some Brazilian percussion and a lot of frame drum stuff I'm into, too, because it really fits well with my Indian technique.
Have you ever taken part in a drum choir?
You know, I really haven't done a lot of that. I have over the years, but I'm looking right now. I'm talking to some drumming friends to really get an actual like drumming group going, like a 3 or 4 person drumming group happening this year. That's one of the projects I'm looking at.
You mentioned earlier about Joe Zawinul. What was your assessment of him as a musician?
Oh, he was wonderful. I mean, the whole Weather Report package. I think that was when he was at his best, when he was with Wayne Shorter doing all the Weather Report stuff. And that's something that was a huge influence on me because I was exposed to it right in high school, in 10th grade. We were listening to Tailspin and Black Market and those kind of records. And then I went back from there and listened to the earlier stuff, like Live in Tokyo. And so I'm pretty familiar with all that stuff.
I Sing the Body Electric is also a nice recording.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything they did that I don't like. You know, some things really influenced me more than others, but they were just fantastic.
It's so deep and so involving. You know, when you listen to them, I remember seeing them in 1977, and that was actually quite an experience. Just watching the way that Shorter and Zawinul played off each other was intriguing.
Yeah, and they had the foresight to get these incredible rhythm sections, and then there was the whole Jaco thing.
Oh man!
I mean, they everything just exploded for me when I heard Weather Report, because it had the rock influence, it had, you know, all the world influence, and then jazz. It had absolutely everything that I love.
What is it that you enjoy about the process of recording?
Well, I like the control of it, you know, that you can. It's almost not fair what you can do these days with Pro Tools and stuff like that. I mean, I'm not saying I love that, or you know, that's another discussion philosophically about what you should be able to do, because jazz, you know, jazz is such a wide term, but there's an aspect of jazz that should be left untouched, and that's when you're improvising. You know, you really need to. I don't think you should go in there and fix solos too much. You know, I think you need to let the thing flow and let what happens happen, or else how could it be jazz? You know, but then there's, you know, for composing, like if you're playing the head of a song, you know, for instance, and someone plays a flat note, you can fix it, or if someone plays rhythmically plays the wrong thing, you can go in there and fix something. Mm. But
how has the internet affected you as a musician?
Oh, the internet. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I found you, or vice versa. I forget how it happened, but I'm thankful for that. And I think for me and a lot of, you know, independent musicians, it's really a special thing because, you know, back in the day, it was just you had to hope to get a record deal. And now we're all sort of our own masters of our own destiny with the internet. And I think it's wide open as to what can happen with it. And that's another part of my, track for 08 is to get things going more and more and explore the internet and use it to its fullest as an independent musician.
It's incredible because you look at musicians pre-internet and they were stifled a lot in not only in terms of creativity but accessibility to an audience, and now it's right there.
Absolutely. The accessibility to the audience, to the whole world, is mind-blowing, and it's very interesting to see what's going to happen now.
And it's the timeliness as well.
Yeah.
You know, there's none of that waiting game going on. It's almost immediate.
Right. And I, you know, on the whole, I got my I hope I could do a little plug that my CD is on CD Baby, and it's also at my website and a bunch of other, you know, it's on iTunes and all the downloadable places you can go to get it.
And your website is www.toddisler.com?
Yep, TODDISLER.com. And then I have a MySpace, too. So, you know, the internet, just we could talk about the internet probably for all day.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, you must get a lot of connections with other musicians as well.
Yeah, sure.
You know, opportunities to perform and even record.
Yeah, I've been in New York over 20 years, so I know a lot of different people in a lot of different scenes, and I've seen it change a lot, too. It's been a good thing to be in New York this long.
One of the cool things is that you can record a segment and then email it off to someone else. They can look at it. And they can build something around that and send it back to you, you know, going back and forth to, it's sort of like playing with Silly Putty over the internet.
You know, that's a great thing. I haven't really done that so much, but yes, people do that all the time. You know, people can send me tracks to learn, you know, or you know, work on, and then I can get back to them without even, it's a little impersonal in that sense, but it is convenient.
I was chatting with someone the other day, and he told me that what he likes the most is that if they're performing in a club and he has to get the charts to the musicians quickly, he just emails them to him.
Yeah.
Before, absolutely. It wasn't like that. You had to fax them or you had to print them off, and, you know, it was pretty involved.
Sure, you can do that now. I do it all the time.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Todd, I want to thank you for dropping by today. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Randy. It's really a pleasure to talk to you.